This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Israel continues its deadly strikes on the Gaza Strip and halts international aid deliveries to the besieged territory. The UN says Israeli airstrikes have targeted a number of hospitals and primary healthcare centers in the Gaza Strip. And Israeli forces killed four more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amid protests at the regime's deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip. Those were the top stories. Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip through air, sea, and land, bombing more civilian targets while keeping in place its blockade on the war-torn territory. Israeli media say nearly 70 locations in Gaza City and Khan Yunis were bombed in half an hour. The regime's artillery also shelled the southern city of Rafah. At least 217 Gazans, nearly half of them women and children, have been killed since Israel launched its attacks last Monday. Meanwhile, an international convoy of humanitarian supplies was stopped at Karam Abu Salem crossing on Tuesday, shortly after Israeli authorities announced the temporary opening of the passage for the delivery of aid. The United Nations has reported an additional influx of displaced Palestinians into Gaza's UN-run schools.
You ask about the total number of displaced. What I can say is, for sure, it is above 52,000 in total. That is the last number that, since the start of the escalation, and as of yesterday, 132 buildings comprising 621 housing and commercial units have been destroyed. In addition, 316 housing units have been severely damaged and rendered uninhabitable.
Jens Lerik noted that Israeli airstrikes have targeted a number of hospitals and primary healthcare centers, as well as the sanitation plant, affecting access to drinking water, or desalination plant that should be for hundreds of thousands of Gazans, actually. Mr. Lerik called on Israel to open the Erez crossing, highlighting the need for sustained humanitarian access into and out of Gaza Strip for staff and goods. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says the region is facing a severe shortage of medical supplies, a risk of waterborne diseases, and the spread of COVID-19 in overcrowded shelters. The developments come as the Palestinian Foreign Minister has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's attacks as war crimes. Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh attacks on Israel, a retaliation for the regime's deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Israeli officials said two people were killed in rocket attacks on the Eshkol region in southern Israel. This has raised the death toll in Israel to 12 since the beginning of the attacks. Earlier, Hamas's military wing said it had targeted an Israeli post east of Gaza with mortar shells. The Azzedine al-Qassam brigades also fired missiles into the Israeli cities of Okfim and Netivot. Before that, the group fired rockets into Sderot and hit a gathering of Israeli soldiers near the city. Other Israeli cities, including Ashkelon and Be'er Sheva, as well as several military bases, were targeted as well. In the past days, Palestinian rocket attacks also hit Tel Aviv. Resistance groups have promised more attacks there if Israel does not stop its airstrikes on Gaza. Four Palestinians have been killed and scores injured in the occupied West Bank as people continue to protest the Israeli regime's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. three people were fatally shot by Israeli forces at the entrance to Al Bire, northeast of Ramallah. Another man was killed earlier on Tuesday in Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil, where people rallied in the thousands. Palestinian authorities say Israeli forces have killed 24 Palestinians in the West Bank since May the 10th. Israeli forces also wounded five people in Lebanon, where a demonstration against the regime's atrocities was held. Meanwhile, a general strike was observed across the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds against Israel's attacks on people in the occupied territories and Gaza.
Palestinians have staged a nationwide general strike across the occupied West Bank and in historic Palestine, the lands occupied in 1948, to protest the ongoing Israeli bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strike has led to the suspension of all economic activities and the closure of educational institutions across the occupied West Bank. Shops and private institutions in Palestinian areas in historic Palestine also closed down. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in Ramallah to support the strike.
We won't tolerate the continuation of the occupation. It must end. The Israeli regime carries out the ugliest practices against our people wherever they are, and then there are the settlers' ongoing violence, and now there are these airstrikes that are killing children and innocent people.
Protesters from all walks of life and of all ages participated in the rally that headed to the northern entrance of the city where Israeli military checkpoint and illegal settlement of Beit Il are located. The protesters held Palestinian flag and chanted anti-Israeli slogans in solidarity with the resistance in the Gaza Strip.
Today, we are rising against Israel's airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and its general operation against Palestinians here in the West Bank.
We are protesting against the ongoing violence against us, the Palestinians, and also to show support for the resistance in Gaza.
The rally, meanwhile, turned violent, with the Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint firing live ammunition. Palestinians of the occupied territories and historic Palestine have united with a general strike and a day of rage to send in numerous messages, on the top an expression of anger against this barbaric aggression by the Israeli occupation. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
A fourth UN Security Council meeting on the issue of Palestine has ended without producing any tangible result due to the U.S. objection. Diplomatic sources say China, Tunisia, and Norway, which have been pushing for action in the council, did not propose a new statement ahead of the talks. This comes after the United States blocked three prior drafts calling for an end to Israel's onslaught. Palestinian envoy Riyad Mansour described as shameful the council's failure to express a unified position to stop the attacks. The chair of the Arab group at the UN also expressed dismay at the Security Council's inability to pronounce itself on the situation. The Irish envoy also slammed the world body's failure to speak out as conflict is raging, resulting in a devastating humanitarian crisis. EU foreign affairs ministers have failed to reach conclusions regarding Israel's escalating violence against the Palestinian people. This as rights groups are calling on the bloc to impose sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
It was billed as an emergency meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers to discuss the deadly violence in the Middle East. In fact, critics of Israel call it an illegal and merciless bombardment of Palestinians rather than a conflict. The ministers couldn't decide on anything concrete, and so the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, ended up playing the event down.
In an informal meeting, there is no formal conclusions. And what I am going to explain you is my takeaway, my intellectual takeaway from the today meeting.
That takeaway basically consisted of merely calling for peace and for Israel's actions to be proportionate. Rights groups insist what's needed instead is for the EU to slap sanctions on Tel Aviv.
EU, especially if they are true and faithful to their own commitment for human rights protection, there is a time that they have to reflect on these issues. And I think also the pressure coming from civil society is playing a very important role.
But as Palestinians continue to suffer, perhaps Israel's influence in the West is too strong. The White House says the U.S. will continue to provide $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel each year, claiming the regime has a right to defend itself.
The United States cannot continue to act alone and try to impose on all of us, including the European Union, their ideas. They have to engage everyone as we engage in the United Nations.
A large number of EU lawmakers have issued statements condemning Israel's actions. Some of these statements have been strongly worded. They insist Israel is guilty of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The MEPs are calling on the EU to suspend its substantial trade with Israel until such time as Tel Aviv stops breaking international laws. EU legislators are due to hold a number of debates on the crisis this week. The big question is, what difference will they make when it comes to the powers that be? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fresh protests have been held in several countries against the ongoing deadly Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. In the U.S., protesters gathered in front of the regime's embassy in Washington, D.C. to condemn Israel's brutality against Palestinians. A similar rally was also held in the city of Dearborn in the U.S. state of Michigan. In Iran, students gathered in the capital, Tehran, to show their support for Palestinians and denounce the Israeli atrocities. In Indonesia, people were out on the streets of the capital, Jakarta, in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and Jerusalem al-Quds. Over the past week, several other cities around the world, including London and Istanbul, have witnessed such rallies as Israel ramped up its attacks against the Palestinians. Now, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has wrapped up the second leg of his European tour. The Iranian top diplomat left Rome after meeting his Italian counterpart and officials from the Vatican State. Max Civili is in Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has concluded his visit to Italy, where he held consultations on the enhancement of mutual cooperation and bilateral ties. On Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio, with whom he talked about political, economic, and cultural aspects in view of the historical relations between Iran and Italy. This year marks the 160th anniversary of formal diplomatic relations between the two countries. Issues related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the ongoing nuclear talks were also on the table.
Italy's position with regard to the nuclear deal is that of waiting to see what might happen. Rome doesn't have an autonomous policy of its own on a number of crucial international issues and is waiting for the US to make a move.
The talks between the two ministers revolved around Italy's posture on the nuclear deal. Years ago, under a Berlusconi government, Rome had the opportunity to play a leading role in the build-up process of the deal, but the role went to Germany in the end. Today, Tehran is assessing whether Italy aims to play a greater role in the revival of the JCPOA.
Also on Monday, Zarif met with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, who presented him with a gift that, the pontiff said, was a symbol of peace with an olive branch and a dove. The Vatican provided no comment on the content of the talks.
During his trip to Europe, the Iranian foreign minister was expected to visit Austria, where Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are holding talks to find a way to revive the international accord. But the visit was cancelled after Vienna's decision to show solidarity with Israel by flying the regime's flag over government office buildings.
Italy has been quite careless on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis over the past years. Rome once held a position of equal closeness with the parts involved in the conflict, not one of equidistance like it is now. Italy was once very attentive to the needs of the Palestinians, whilst today its stance doesn't help finding a solution to the crisis for which Israel bears grave responsibilities.
On Tuesday, on his final day in Rome, Zarif met with a delegation of lawmakers from the Italian parliament at the Iranian ambassador's residence. Max Civili, Press TV, Rome.
Iranian lawmakers have stressed that Iran will not settle for anything less than the verifiable removal of all sanctions against it before it returns to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal commitments. In a statement, 200 MPs said, if sanctions are not terminated 100%, it means none of the bans are removed. The lawmakers said the parliament is seriously seeking the U.S.'s complete, verifiable, and irreversible sanctions disarmament. They said the parliament would not agree to any classification of sanctions that would maintain any economic pressure on Iran. The parliament members said so far the negotiations in Vienna to restore the nuclear deal show that the U.S. and Europe have not had the serious resolve to remove all of the sanctions against Iran. Prosecutors in the state of North Carolina say the officers involved in the killing of a black man last month will not face any charges. District Attorney Andrew Womble said the death of Andrew Brown Jr. was, quote, tragic but justified. He added that the sheriff deputies who fatally shot Brown reasonably believed it was necessary to use deadly force. The prosecution claimed the black man recklessly drove at the officers, that is, while trying to flee arrest. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the Brown family has objected to the North Carolina state's decision to drop charges against the involved officers. The attorney said the deputies did not act safely during the interaction that led to the victim's death. Brown was shot twice on April the 21st, including once in the back of the head. The UK has entered its final month of lifting lockdown restrictions. In England and Scotland, people are now allowed to visit friends and family in their homes for the first time this year. Under the UK government's lockdown roadmap, all limits on social contact are set to be dropped next month. But concerns over the Indian variant of COVID-19 might throw a spanner into the works. That's it for me for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. charities are funding Israeli regime settler organizations working to evict Palestinians from their East Al-Quds homes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alex Kane, writer. This article is published under the heading Tax-Exempt U.S. Nonprofits Fuel Israeli Regime Settler Push to Evict Palestinians. Stay tuned for more. On May 6, right-wing Israeli regime officials descended on Sheikh Jarrah a neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, to show their support for the settler movement's push to displace Palestinian residents and take their homes. One of the officials was Arya King, a deputy mayor of Al-Quds and settler who lives in the Palestinian neighborhood of Ras al-Amud. In an exchange caught on camera, King mocked Palestinian activist Muhammad Abu Hummus for being shot by Israeli regime forces in his backside and then pointing at his head, said, "It's a pity it didn't go in here." The impending removal of Palestinian families from Sheikh Jarrah fueled tensions in Al-Quds, which spiraled out of the holy city into Gaza and the rest of Palestine. The Zionist regime airstrikes are now blanketing Gaza. King is one of the players, among others, who has stoked tensions in Sheikh Jarrah, the site of a long simmering crisis. In 2007, King started the group Israel Land Fund. The Israel Land Fund isn't trying to dominate East Al-Quds by itself. It's doing it with the help of private American donors who get tax deductions for the money they give to U.S.-based nonprofits who funnel the money into Israeli settlements. The overwhelming majority of the Israel Land Fund's budget comes from the Central Fund of Israel, a U.S.-based nonprofit. The Central Fund of Israel is among a network of U.S.-based groups fueling dispossession and displacement of Palestinians from neighborhoods in Al-Quds to make way for Jewish settlers. The group's tax-exempt nonprofit status means their donors receive an effective U.S. government subsidy to bolster the settlement movement. From 2009 to 2013, U.S. charities funneled over $220 million to Israeli settler organizations. According to a 2015 Haaretz investigation, U.S. nonprofit central involvement in the Israeli settler movement has sparked calls among Palestinian rights advocates for the U.S. government to investigate the U.S.-based organizations fueling Palestinian displacement. Reached by phone, on the number listed on the Central Fund of Israel's website, a man who refused to give his name declined to comment on the group's activities, saying, "My history with journalists has been so horrible, I'm not interested." An Israel Land Fund spokesperson said, "ILF is not involved in any illegal act." The spokesperson told The Intercept that the group is not involved so much in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israel Land Fund assisted in the eviction of a Palestinian family in Sheikh Jarrah in 2017, and King openly advertises that one of his major targets is a neighborhood. "In about 10 years, we will have in Sheikh Jarrah some 400, maybe 500 Jewish families," King told the Jerusalem Post in 2017. The Israel Land Fund advertises residential plots in what the group calls Nahalot Shimon, the Hebrew name given to parts of Sheikh Jarrah. Two other Al-Quds neighborhoods, Batan al-Hawa and al-Bustan, are also facing a wave of eviction orders instigated by U.S. nonprofit-backed settler groups. The Sheikh Jarrah and al-Bustan eviction plans, which threaten the homes of some 2,000 Palestinians, were condemned as violations of international law by 25 House Democrats in a letter sent to Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently, calling on the State Department to pressure the Zionist regime over the pending forced displacement. The organization behind the targeting of 8 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah is a U.S.-registered real estate firm by the name of Nahalot Shimon. Though the Israel Land Fund is not linked to the current round of evictions, King is loudly advocating for it because it will help his dream of turning Sheikh Jarrah into a Palestinian-free, Jewish-only settlement. In 2017, King's organization helped evict 8 members of the Shemansne family from their home in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israel Land Fund contacted the era what the courts said were the original Jewish owners and represented her in legal proceedings to kick the family out. The Central Fund of Israel, the main funder of King's Group, is a New York registered nonprofit run by Jay Marcus, the owner of a textile company that takes in millions of dollars every year from donors who get to write off the checks as tax deductions. Since 2011, the CFI has given the Israel Land Fund over $720,000 for its settlement activities, according to documents filed to Israeli regulators and reviewed by The Intercept. In 2017, the Central Fund of Israel's donation constituted 99.2% of the Israel Land Fund's total budget. Such arrangements between U.S. nonprofit groups and Israeli settler organizations are not uncommon. 2 miles to the south of Sheikh Jarrah lie the Silwa neighborhoods of Batan al-Halwa and al-Bustan, which are both in the crosshairs of Israeli settlers. In November 2020, an Israeli court ruled in favor of Israeli settler group Ataret Kohanim's request to displace 87 Palestinians from their homes in Batan al-Halwa. Ataret Kohanim is backed by the U.S.-based American Friends of Ataret Kohanim, which delivers tax-deductible donations to the settler group. According to the site Charity Navigator, which tracks such groups, in September 2020, the Internal Revenue Service automatically revoked the American Friends tax-exempt status because the group failed to file documents with the U.S. government. In 2017, the last year records are available. The group gave its settler counterparts over $525,000. And in Al-Bustan, 88 Palestinian homes are facing demolition orders to make way for archaeological attractions meant to showcase the ancient Jewish link to the area. The group instigating the demolitions is Elad, an Israeli settler group, which in turn is funded in part by Friends of Er David, a U.S.-based nonprofit. Friends of Er David gave $36 million to the Israeli group between 2006 to 2013, according to Haaretz. They depend on their donors' money, said Hagit Ofran, the director of Israeli group Peace Now Settlement Watch. Without the donors, there is no settlement in East Al-Quds. The leading role U.S. charities play in displacement of Palestinians has prompted Palestinian rights advocates to call for increased scrutiny of the nonprofits.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. I'm your host, Haider al-Bahadli, and today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Sayyid, salamun alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
How are you, Sayyid?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you.
Sayyid, we have another very hot topic and a question regarding, equality. Between the genders. The question is as follows. Why does women in Islam get a lesser share of inheritance than a man does. Isn't that oppression?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we need to know the role of man and woman in this world. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He has created us, He created us in two forms, male and female. Wherever there is a duty of socializing with the people, or socializing outside, working and hard working, Allah gave these duties to men. And therefore He said you need to provide sustenance for your family members. On the other hand, where there was the duty of training kids, to train kids to become a good person in the society, a good politician, a good poet, for example, a good writer, a good scholar. So these things are put on the shoulders of the woman, being a mother. And He gave this duty to the woman. Now, unfortunately, obviously, in this time, we see like the duties are being exchanged. The society that we are looking at, in which we do not see good people, good ethical people, is because the mothers are no more being attentive to their kids.
They're not invested in educating their kids anymore.
Yeah, huh? They're not educating. They're not basically looking after them the way they should. They're not teaching them the basic ethics which they need. And that's why in the society we have these issues. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Islam has given the the most of the rights to the women. And the rights which are given, it is justly, because Islam is the religion of just. It's not the religion of equality.
Mm.
There's a difference in the equality and justice. Equality and justice is, for example, if someone is working 1 hour, a clay man, for example, is working for 1 hour, and there is another clay man who's working for 10 hours, the equality says, the rule of equality says, give both of them equal wage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the rule of justice says, give him the money of 1 hour, give that person the money for 10 hours, because he has worked more.
Mm-hmm.
So Islam is the religion of justice. On top of that, we can see like the structure of the male and female. The male body structure is stronger than the female's.
The natural.
The natural. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the body structure of the man and female. So the duty of bringing sustenance and working outside, this is on the shoulders of man, and training people, like training the kids, brought up, which is the hardest duty, I think, which a man cannot do. It's just a woman who can do this, like brought up a kid or a child. It's not in the hands of man's to do this. The way mothers does it, the way child listen to his mother, he never listens to the father this
exactly.
way. And the father do not have that stamina and patience which mother have.
Exactly.
You know?
That's true. That is true.
There are many videos you can see like on the internet that when the kids are left with the father, what happens,
exactly.
what they're doing with the kids, and when they're next to mother, how they're living. Yes. So basically, we need to accept all these things. There is no doubt that this woman can go out and work like a man.
Exactly.
There is no doubt in it.
Yeah.
But the point is, this is not her duty.
She's not lesser qualified.
But she's
she
not.
Might even be better than
Allah them. Has given the capacity of doing everything to her as well.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, this is not her duty. Her duty is to deal with the kids, with the patience, with the love, and these
with
are
creating
the
new nation, bringing it up, the new generation.
This is a big duty, like bringing up a new generation on the good, like grounds.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big duty, and that's what we're looking for. Why we send our kids to the schools is to learn, not just learning ABC, for example, or calculating 1, 2, 3. But rather to learn some ethics as well, to deal with the people.
To become a good citizen.
To society. Become a good citizen in the society, yes. Mm-hmm. So these are the duties of mother, basically, which obviously they have forgotten. Now, on the other hand, it's the man's duty to bring sustenance. So therefore, Islam divides the rules according to the just. Like the division is according to the just.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So how does this apply?
That's the first part of this question, that it's not on the basis of equality, because equality does not answer in any grounds. Mm. So we need to be just, because Allah is just. Now, how this apply on the inheritance? In inheritance, Allah has justly given the portions in inheritance. Male, because he has to go out and bring sustenance for the whole family, for wife and kids as well. So he has to get more because he's struggling more. And then he can, if he wants to invest somewhere or working, so he needs that.
From an Islamic perspective, it's obligation.
It's an obligation from Islamic perspective, yes. Yeah. On the other hand, woman, because she's at home, she had a husband. Mm. The husband is bringing all the sustenance.
Exactly.
She's not working. Therefore, there is a less share.
So
that's from one perspective answer. The other perspective is because people do not know about the rulings of inheritance, that's why they say ladies or women are getting less share than men.
Before we dive into this, let me just understand this correctly, that the man is obligated to spend his money that he inherits on his family, on his wife, on his daughters, on his sisters and mothers. He's obligated to do so. But the daughter of a deceased father is not obligated to spend a nickel
on
her brother, on her father, on her husband, on her sons. It's for herself.
Yes.
So that's why she gets a lesser share.
That is also for the man. That portion is also for the man. But obviously he has a family where he has to spend. He cannot keep everything for himself like it's from my father.
So he gets something. Like, let's say that he gets $100. He must spend it on his family, on the females from his family, and his sons and his brothers. And I'm not sure about brothers. His fathers, his parents, and his sons and daughters and wife, of course. But if the female gets a share, $50, she gets half of it, she's not obligated to spend $1, not even on herself. Yes. Is that right?
She can keep
it for herself.
Yeah, it's for her. And that's the main difference. Like, the man, basically, he is, we can say, like, madhulum. How we can call
it. So he is, like, being oppressed here.
Yes, he's been oppressed.
So he gets $100 that he must use on them.
He must use, and he has to, like, spend it on his family. He's basically dividing, and he's using that for his family, whereas the lady, there's no obligation on lady. You know, the way man has the obligation to bring sustenance in the family, there is no obligation on lady. If the woman is working...
Even if she's rich?
Yes, whatever.
Even if she's rich.
No matter whatever she has.
Not even her parents?
Even if she's working. For example, if there's a couple, the male and female both are working, the male, from the Islamic perspective, he has to sustain or bring food for the house from the money which he's earning. The female, if she's earning, that's all for her.
This is not an ethical obligation. This is a lawful obligation.
Yes, lawful obligation. Obviously, we're talking about the lawful.
Wajib shara'an.
Yes, wajib and shara'an, like from Sharia point of view. But ethically, if she is obviously contributing, that's another ethically, like we can say, like it's ethically she should do to help the husband. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is people do not know about the rulings of inheritance. For example, in inheritance, it is said like the person who is dying, he can he can specify 1/3 of his wealth, that portion, 1/3 of the portion of his wealth, to anyone he wants. Now, if husband is giving that 1/3 portion to the wife, she's getting more than the kids.
Exactly.
If a person has $100, and generally we know that the 8th person is for the wife.
One eighth is for the wife.
And
those
then
kids.
The 2 parts for the boy and 1 part for the girl. A person who have 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls, and a wife. Now, generally they say like, oh, wife is getting 1/8. The mother is getting 1/8.
She's getting less than the
less
children.
Than the others. Now, if we can count 1/8 of the $100 is...
One eighth of 80 to make it easier. I'm not sure if it's becoming
easier. Let's make
easier.
It from $100.
From $100, how much
from
is
From $100, just make one eighth.
It's eight?
No, it's divided in eight portions, yes. So...
$12.5
goes to the wife, number one.
Yes.
Then the husband is giving one third of his wealth to the wife.
As well.
So it adds on that eight portion which she has.
Yes.
Okay. And after that, what is left, then we need to make, for example, if it is two boys, they will make like four portions. And plus girls. Two girls will be six.
So she will get almost half of it.
Yes.
Just to, I don't want to confuse the listeners.
Yes.
She will get almost
because
half
one third,
of the inheritance.
Yes. One third is obviously 33,
three,
for example,
and then
plus
one
12.
Eighth, 12, exactly. And then the kids, the four kids.
It's 45.
They will
so she's getting 45 out of 100.
Yeah.
And
she will get a lot more.
The kid. Basically, we need to know the inheritance rulings as well. The main point in this is we just look at the... You know, the outer face of the rule. Rule says a 1/8 is for the wife, for example, or half is for the daughter. If there is a man who have only two kids, a boy and a daughter, there is another way to give. So if we want to give more portion to the woman, there are ways. You know, Islam does not say like from you have to just give 1/8 to the woman, to the wife, and you cannot give anything else.
It's not like that. So we shouldn't take the rules out of context.
Yeah.
And it goes back again to what we were talking about in a previous episode. It goes back to ignorance and people not understanding that the rules of Islam is rules made to create justice in society,
you know,
not equality.
The main problem is because we all are ignorant, that's why we are wrongly interpreting the Islam. We need to first get the knowledge of Islam. We need to know the rulings of Islam. We need to know Quran at least. What does it say? And after that, try to judge something. With the ignorance, when we say, obviously that will spread these kind of things, like Islam has no equality, it's all not on the basis of equality, or the Islamophobia, the way we like mentioned in the previous program. It's all because of the ignorance.
Exactly. Very, very precious advice that we hope we can abide by. Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid, thank you very much. This is your host, Haider al-Bahadli, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Among the most critical goals that the Palestinians have achieved in the Gaza Strip was to demonstrate the failure of the Iron Dome to intercept all incoming domestically manufactured rockets targeting Israeli-occupied areas. Gaza flooded the Israeli sophisticated interception systems when launching over 100 rockets simultaneously. We're prepared for an article written by Elijah J. Magnier, a veteran war correspondent and a senior political risk analyst with decades of experience covering the West Asia region. The piece is titled Gaza Hits Israel's Prestige Despite Tel Aviv's Claim to Being Superpower. With its different Palestinian factions, Gaza collectively consecrated the state of Palestinian consciousness of all Palestine and achieved its goal of breaking the prestige of Israel, despite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's claim that it had become a superpower, not just a regional power. This new Palestinian awareness was achieved following the Israeli escalation and aggressive campaign against the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, inhabited by more than 38 Palestinian families threatened with eviction from their homes. The Israeli regime also savagely attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque demonstrators. The destiny of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has become an international issue that raises global awareness and solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. The Palestinian cause had been absent from the international arena following a number of Arab regimes' normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, and when former U.S. President Donald Trump offered all of Al-Quds to the Israeli regime. However, the battle in Gaza is not expected to stop soon because Israel is trying to restore its so-called deterrent power it has lost due to the Palestinian missiles successfully fired from the Gaza Strip. Moreover, what is unusual is the uprising of the 1948 Arabs. After 72 years of occupation, in the city of Lida in particular, and in other Israeli-occupied cities, they have proven that the new generation wants to regain their occupied territory, rejecting the unsuccessful Oslo and Camp David agreements. It is highly plausible that the Israeli regime has also acted in its own interest by disrupting the Palestinian presidential elections that coincided with the illegal eviction of the Sheikh Jarrah families to prevent the Palestinians in the city of Al-Quds from participating in the polls. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is undoubtedly aware that attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the inhabitants of the city of Al-Quds is like lighting the fuse of a powder keg. The first and the second intifada were the best proof of these explosive possibilities. Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all other factions in the Gaza Strip have succeeded in achieving unity with Al-Quds by defending it. Hamas did not start bombing Israeli settlements before giving Israel many hours to stop attacking the civilian population in the city of Al-Quds. However, Tel Aviv insisted on its position and dragged everyone into the battle so that Benjamin Netanyahu would achieve his goal to postpone the Israeli elections to save his political future. The Palestinian groups in Gaza attacked Tel Aviv, Ashkelon, Ashdod with hundreds of rockets that reached not far from Haifa. The Israeli officials failed to anticipate the intensity of the Palestinian rocket response and the reaction to its abuse of power and bombing of the Gaza Strip. The various resistance groups proved their credibility with timing and intimidation. They gained more significant popularity among the Palestinians and the Arab populations supporting the cause and against the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Among the most critical goals that the Palestinians have achieved in the Gaza Strip was to demonstrate the failure of Israel's so-called Iron Dome system to intercept all incoming domestically manufactured rockets targeting Israeli-occupied areas. Gaza flooded the Israeli sophisticated interception systems when launching over 100 rockets simultaneously. Israel admitted it could not stop the firing of rockets, even though the Israeli army bombed dozens of targets. To harm the population, the Zionist regime bombed several civilian towers, the Al-Hanadi Tower, the Al-Juhara, and the Al-Shuruq Tower in Gaza, in prestigious commercial and residential areas, with the intention to turn the inhabitants against the Palestinian groups confronting Israel. The Palestinian Ministry of Health has announced that recent Israeli strikes have taken the martyrdom toll in the Gaza Strip to 188, including 55 children and 33 women, with 1,230 Palestinians injured. The Palestinian groups were able to launch more than 1,300 rockets. Embarrassing scenes appeared of members of the Israeli Knesset and the Ministry of Defense fleeing to bomb shelters. Not only has Israel lost its ability to deter, but it has also lost its prestige. The story of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, in the aftermath of the 1948 expulsion of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, around 750,000 Palestinians were forced to flee their homes to neighboring countries. Following these events, 28 families, today there are 38 families, settled in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds in 1956. They reached an agreement with the Jordanian Ministry of Construction and Development and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNRWA, to provide housing for them in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. At that time, the occupied West Bank was under Jordanian rule from 1951 to 1967. The Jordanian government provided the land, while UNRWA covered the cost of constructing 28 homes for these Palestinian families. It was agreed that the residents pay a symbolic fee, provided that the ownership was transferred to the residents more than 3 years from the completion of the construction. This, however, was interrupted by the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, including the city of Al-Quds in 1967, which prevented the registration of the houses under the names of the Palestinian families. This month, Jordan's foreign ministry said it had provided the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs with 14 ratified agreements meant for the people of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in eastern Al-Quds, which support their claim of their lands and property. In a statement, Jordan's foreign ministry said it handed over a certificate to the residents proving that the Jordanian Ministry of Construction and Development had agreed with UNRWA to establish 28 housing units in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to be delegated and registered in the name of these Palestinian families. However, the process was interrupted as a result of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank in 1967. The Jordanian Foreign Ministry had previously provided the Palestinian side with all the documents that could help these residents of Al-Quds maintain their full rights, including lease contracts, lists of beneficiaries' names, and a copy of the agreement concluded with UNRWA back in 1954. In 1972, the Sephardic Committee and the Knesset Committee of Israel claimed that they owned the land on which the houses were built in 1885 and asked the court to evict four Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, accusing them of land grab. In 1982, the Israeli settlement Associations filed an eviction case against 24 Palestinian families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and 17 families assigned Israeli lawyer Tosia Cohen to defend them. The lawyer in 1991 signed an agreement without the knowledge of the families that the ownership of the land belonged to the settlement associations. The lawyer put Palestinian families under the threat of eviction if they failed to pay the rent to the settlement associations. In 1997, Suleiman Darwish Hijazi, a resident, filed a lawsuit with the Israeli Central Court to prove his land ownership, using title deeds issued by the Ottoman Empire, brought from Turkey. However, the move backfired when the Israeli court rejected the claim in 2005. The court said the papers did not prove his land ownership, and Hijazi's appeal in the following year was rejected. In November 2008, the Al-Kurd family was evicted from their home, followed by eviction of the Hanun and Al-Qawi families in August of 2009. So far, 12 Palestinian families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood have received eviction orders issued by the Israeli Central and Magistrate Courts. Four Palestinian families filed a petition with the Israeli Supreme Court, Israel's highest judicial body, against the decision to expel them from their homes. The Israeli Central Court in Eastern Al-Quds approved the decision earlier this year to evict four Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in favor of right-wing, illegal Israeli settlers. In 1948, Al-Sabaq's family forcibly expelled from their home in Yaffa, which Israelis now inhabit. The Al-Sabaq family, a 32-member family, including 10 children, is afraid that the court verdict will make them and their family refugees again.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.